Hey, kumomai. Welcome to Hawaii Real Estate, a podcast on the buying, selling, and leasing of real property in Hawaii. Each episode of our podcast consists of a real data report, which analyzes Hawaii's most recent real property data, and a focus piece, which provides legal and other special insight into a matter of major and contemporary concern for Hawaii real estate transactions. The Hawaii Real Estate Podcast is produced by the Hawaii Association of Realtors, with support from its Legal Kukua program. New episodes of the podcast are released on the first Wednesday of each month. Today is Wednesday, December 6th, 2023. Our focus piece for this episode analyzes whether real estate commission lawsuits filed against the National Association of Realtors and certain large brokerages in various federal courts across the country impact real estate practice here in Hawaii. But before we get to that, we look at how real estate sales fared in Hawaii last month and analyze whether mortgage rates will likely increase, decrease, or stabilize in the near future. Here is a Hawaii Real Data Report. Let's start our real data report with a look at mortgage rates, which for the first time in about 2 years are falling. The 30-year fixed rate weekly mortgage average in the United States from November 2nd to November 30th dropped from 7.75% to 7.22%. During that same period, the 15-year fixed rate mortgage average dropped from 7.03% to 6.56%. So both the 30-year and 15-year fixed rate mortgage averages dropped over the past month by about a half a basis point. A half basis point mortgage rate decline is nothing to sneeze at. The median listing price for a home in Hawaii is $849,500. Assuming a 20% down payment, the monthly payment to purchase that home with a 15-year fixed rate mortgage just declined by $177. And the monthly payment to purchase that same home with a 30-year fixed rate mortgage just declined by $251. Those are significant monthly savings that could create buyer demand, propel home prices, and quicken the pace of home sales. But the real story is the trend reversal. Mortgage rates, since early 2021, have generally been on the rise. Last month's weekly mortgage averages reversed that trend. Mortgage rates are now on the decline, and the market expects that decline to continue. Just look to the 10-year Treasury yield, which generally manifests the market's inflation expectations. If the market believes that inflation will lower, the market will be more likely to accept a lower yield bond. So lowering yields on the 10-year Treasury note indicates the market's belief that inflation will decline. Inflation, of course, is the main driver behind the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee's decisions to raise or lower the target federal funds rate, the benchmark rate at which banks lend money. If the Fed expects inflation to top 2%, the Fed generally raises interest rates to combat the rising cost of goods and services. Mortgage rates have increased over the past couple of years, largely because the Federal Reserve keeps raising the target federal funds rate, and therefore the cost of borrowing. But the Fed has recently expressed that it has become leery about raising rates further. Speaking to the Economic Club of New York before the Open Market Committee's last meeting, Chairman Powell acknowledged the breakneck pace by which the Federal Reserve had raised interest rates and confirmed that decisions to raise interest rates further would be made with caution.
Turning to monetary policy, the FOMC has tightened policy substantially over the past 18 months, increasing the federal funds rate by 525 basis points at a historically fast pace and decreasing our securities holdings by roughly $1 trillion. Given the uncertainties and risks, and given how far we've come, the committee is proceeding carefully.
In other words, unless there was a major change in inflation, the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee's next meeting would not likely result in yet another interest rate hike. And when the Federal Open Market Committee met in October, it didn't raise interest rates. Instead, it concluded the threat of inflation has subsided sufficiently to conclude that the target interest rates should remain within their current target ranges. When it made this decision, the Federal Reserve relied on its favorite measure of inflation, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, which, when the Fed met in October, showed a 0.4% change from the preceding month and a 3.4% change from the prior year. The current PCE price index shows a 0% change in the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index from the preceding month and a 3% change from a year ago. In short, inflation is even lower than it was when the Fed last met and decided not to raise interest rates. So now the Fed has even more reason to keep interest rates constant or to perhaps consider lowering them. Plus, the market believes that inflation will continue to lessen. Remember that the 10-year Treasury yield generally indicates whether the market believes that inflation will increase or decrease. When the yield is low, the market believes that inflation will lessen. because the 10-year Treasury yield dropped this past month from 4.875% to 4.352%, we can confidently conclude that the market, like the Fed, also believes that inflation will continue to abate. The trend towards lowering mortgage rates that we first saw last month may very well then continue. How are Hawaii home sales doing in this changing real estate market? Median listing prices in Hawaii remain high. Compared to this time last year, the median listing price for a home in Hawaii County is up 6.53%, up in Maui County by 3.2%, and up in Kauai County by 3.76%. Those year-over-year changes compare well against the nation, which during that same time saw only a 0.96% increase in median listing prices. Monthly data looks particularly good for Hawaii. From October to November, when the nation saw median listing prices decrease by 1.18%, median listing prices in the city and county of Honolulu increased by 0.03%, increased in Hawaii County by 4.34%, and increased in Maui County by 3.62%. All told, median listing prices throughout the state were the following for November 2023. In the city and county of Honolulu, $799,000. In Hawaii County, $646,925. In Maui County, $1,372,500. In Kauai County, $1,572,000. Selling these homes is generally taking less time. On a year-over-year basis, the median days a home stays in the market in the city and county of Honolulu is down 5.66%. In Hawaii County, it's down 2.43%. And in Kauai County, it's down 3.41%. The active listings, however, remain low. On a year-over-year basis, active listings in the city and county of Honolulu are down by 1.76%. In Hawaii County, they're down 2.77%. In Maui County, they're down 12.58%. And in Kauai County, they're down 6.8%. All of this may change, of course, if mortgage rates continue to hold steady or decline as expected. And now, for a focus piece. The National Association of Realtors and certain large brokerages are defending against several multi-district class action lawsuits alleging that cooperating broker commissions, as currently structured or practiced, constitute unlawful, anti-competitive price fixing or unfair or deceptive acts or practices. A jury verdict in one case, Sitzer Burnett, found the National Association of Realtors and the other defendants in that case liable to the class plaintiffs for $1.7 billion. NAR has committed to appealing the verdict. In the meantime, other similar real estate commission-based private lawsuits are pending throughout the country. In complicating matters further, the United States Department of Justice's Antitrust Division continues its efforts to open a second investigation into NAR's participation rule, requiring brokers to offer the same commission to all buyer-side brokers when listing a particular property for sale on an MLS, and clear cooperating policy, requiring listing brokers to publish a property listing on an MLS within one business day of beginning to market that property. In this focus piece, Hawaii Realtors President Kalama Kim interviews me, Jason Corder, the Hawaii Realtors staff attorney, about what impact, if any, these cooperative broker commission lawsuits, as well as the DOJ's attempts to once again challenge NAR's participation rule and clear cooperation policy, could have on real estate practice in Hawaii. Nothing in this podcast creates or confirms an attorney-client relationship, nor does any information contained in this podcast constitute legal advice. You are urged to seek qualified legal counsel of competent jurisdiction for answers to all your legal questions. Okay. With that, please enjoy Kalama Kim's interview with me, Jason Corder, on the Real Estate Commission lawsuits.
You're in for a treat today. You're about to view a video of me interviewing legal counsel of Hawaii Realtors, Jason Corder. And it's going through the evolution of lawsuits that are happening throughout our industry and throughout our country that may have effect on our business. The reason I'm telling you this first is because as we go through it, you hear a lot of legal information. It's important to note this is not concluded, that we're only in the very beginning of what's going to happen, that we're not telling you to go and make all these, any change to your brokerage firm practices or how you individually run your business. That's, you get to decide that. We want to make sure that you're aware of the information and that you can prepare as needed as it comes through. So as you hear this interview and you get more information, keep that in mind, because we are in inning number one of 9 inning or maybe extra innings of a baseball game, and you don't know what's going to evolve over time. So think about that as you watch this interview and absorb all the information so you can continue to be a professional practitioner in real estate. Aloha, members. I'm Kalama Kim, your 2023 Hawaii Realtors President. On October 31st, we heard about a verdict in a class action lawsuit in Missouri. And that verdict may have consequences that will affect our industry moving forward, because it was against the National Association of Realtors and some national real estate brands. So I'm here today with Hawaii Realtors legal counsel, Jason Korda, to have him answer a few of our questions. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you, Kalama.
Are you ready for our questions?
Fire away.
Now, we even wrote them down just to make sure, because I know with lawyers, we need to be precise.
We're very ornery people.
Okay. Here's the first one. So as I mentioned, NAR news outlets reported a verdict of a large sum of money, and that was against NAR and a few national brokerage firms on October 31st. Can you tell us more about that lawsuit and what was ruled?
Sure. You're referring to the Sitzer-Barnett verdict, which is a $1.7 billion judgment rendered in Missouri. That verdict actually may increase or decrease depending on how the judge decides certain post-trial motions. And there is an opportunity to what they call treble it, which means triple it, but the judge has to make certain findings before that. Also, as in the case with all jury verdicts, a judge could reduce the amount awarded, so it could be below $1.7 billion. The point, I think, is the point that you made, which is that it's a large verdict. And it was issued recently, I believe October 31st of this year. The jury believed that the practice of offering unilateral cooperating broker commissions that are effectively non-negotiable was sort of an act of price fixing, or at least something meant to stabilize commissions between brokers or to even increase them above what normally the market would support.
And follow-up question here, because it was a ruling against NAR.
Yeah.
Does that mean as an NAR member, it's a ruling against me or just the association?
That's an excellent question. So first, we have strong indications from our NAR president, as well as arguments made by NAR attorneys in related but separate cases, that the NAR will appeal the verdict in Burnett. So it doesn't apply to members for that reason, for sure. And we're in sort of a wait and see pattern right now, which I'm sure is quite frustrating to people listening. It's quite frustrating to me as well. The legal process works slow. So, yeah.
And what does NAR say they're going to do next?
NAR's president has committed to appealing the verdict, mm-hmm. and they are taking actions in the separate but related cases that support the conclusion that they are maintaining that commitment to appeal the Sitzer-Barnett verdict.
Okay. So when an appeal happens, is that a short process, a long process?
It's a long, laborious, treacherous process with ornery people. There was a post-trial motion schedule set up in that Sitzer-Barnett case that is going to run through March of next year, so through March of 2024. Mm-hmm. At that point, the judge will take all those motions to the written papers to the parties file, support of their case under advisement, and then render a decision. So this is where we'll find out whether, for instance, there would be a higher or lower verdict, mm-hmm. and whether the judge will implement any potential nationwide rules. So we've got a while to go before there can be any kind of what they call injunctive relief. So that's just an order by the court to do or not do something. Long story short, it won't be until at least April of next year before we hear anything from a federal judge saying that any practice must or must not be changed.
And then when you said appeal, that's not the appeal. The appeal would happen after we know what the judge is going to do.
Yes, thank you, Coleman. That's a very good point. So this is the first part's still not done yet. They have post-trial motions that are going to run through March of next year. And then following that, yes, the appeal would occur.
And then that appeal takes months, years, decades?
Years, mostly.
Years. Could,
yeah.
Okay.
And then, so they just were at, there are three levels, right? The federal court system, there's the trial court system. That's what you can envision when you're watching like Law and Order at home. You know, there's a witness on the stand. People stand up and go, I object. You know, that kind of thing. That's what we just went through. The next step would be what's called the Court of Appeals. And then there's still one more step after that. They could do it with the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. So all told, this thing could take like 4-6 years.
And have both parties, and that means the plaintiffs, the class action group that's suing, and defendants, and that's NAR, and other national brands like Home Services and like Keller Williams that were included in the plaintiff's ruling. So they can all appeal both sides, like if the judge says, no, I'm reversing this ruling.
Yeah.
Then the plaintiff could appeal too.
Yeah, right.
So likely we're at the very beginning stages of all of this.
Yes, yeah.
You mentioned some other lawsuits that we're dealing with. What similar lawsuits? What's going on with the different lawsuits out there?
I think it's helpful to break them into groups. There are a few of them out there. I'll mention the most important groups. Mm-hmm. So the one that's within the same group as that Sitzer Burnett case, the one we just talked about there, is another case called Morrell. Mm-hmm. That's a case out of the Northern District of Illinois. It's another federal case. And it's based on the same principles that the Sitzer Burnett case is based on. Mm-hmm. They're alleging that there's basically price fixing that occurs because of these commission offers are unilateral and basically non-negotiable. That case had a hearing recently, and the hearing was on a proposed settlement between RE/MAX and...
Anywhere.
Thank you. So, quick step back. Mm-hmm. The decision we were speaking about in Sitzer Burnett mm-hmm. likely will not apply to those two parties, RE/MAX and Anywhere, because they've entered into a proposed settlement agreement. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason why I say likely is because it hasn't been approved by the court. The settlement agreement is for both cases, though, which is sort of the reason why these two cases are linked. They're linked not just because they're alleging kind of the same things, but also because the settlement agreement sort of straddles both of them. Mm-hmm. There was a hearing in the Sitzer Burnett case on, I believe, the 20th of November mm-hmm. as to whether to accept it. And the judge ordered that it be preliminary accepted. Mm-hmm. Fast forward a week, there was a hearing in Morrell, that other case, mm-hmm. the related one. And they had a hearing on basically the same thing. And the judge said, I don't want to accept it or reject it until we know more about what's happening in that first case, the Sitzer Burnett case. And we know that the post-trial motions were run through at least March. Mm. So now we're waiting in both cases for that process to finish. The major difference between the two, like I said, they're very similar in that they allege basically the same thing. The major difference is Morrell is just a larger case.
The first case was in Missouri, the one they already ruled on.
That's right.
The second one said, we're going to wait on part of this settlement until we know what happens to the first.
Yeah.
And I think they've said they're not going to do any, then they're not going to go to court until the end of next year.
Yes. So that Morrell court, that second case, mm-hmm. in that hearing I mentioned that occurred after the 20th, so I think it was the 27th of this month, of November, excuse me, they began discussing when the trial would occur. Mm-hmm. And the judge informed the parties during the hearing, I sat in and listened to the hearing. She said that she was beginning scheduling trials for the fall of next year, fall of 2024. Mm-hmm. And they still hadn't scheduled the trial at that point. So wow. I would say that the earliest we can expect a trial to occur in that second case is fall 2024. And in fact, it would likely occur later if it actually reaches trial. Yeah. And it may not even reach trial, right? So we'll see. Mm-hmm.
And when you say it may not reach trial, maybe settled, there might be other things. Yeah, okay. All right. And then you were grouping, so those two are grouped together.
Yes.
You're grouping other lawsuits. There are other lawsuits, too.
Yes. That's right. Yeah. One more in that first group. There's one called Burtun, B-U-R-T-U-N. Mm-hmm. That's sort of like a copycat.
And it has nothing to do with former HAR Hawaii Realtors President Burtun.
No, that's right. Okay. We
got to put humor in this. I hope you're watching Burtun. Yeah. Okay. Let's hear about this Burtun lawsuit.
It alleges basically the same things that were alleged in the Sitzer Burnett one and in the Morrell one, but it's filed in South Carolina. The District of South Carolina.
Okay.
And it was filed five, maybe 6 days after we got a verdict in the Sitzer Burnett case. It was a copycat style case. Mm-hmm. This happens a lot in civil cases and particularly class mm-hmm. actions, of which this is. Mm-hmm. There'll be other attorneys just sort of like watching what's happening in the nation, and they see something that works, then they go, does this exist where I am? And mm-hmm. if it worked someplace else, could it work for me? And then, and then so that there is a tendency to duplicate after there is some kind of precedent showing success.
That's why we have lots of McDonald's on the island.
Yeah.
Right?
Because it works there.
Yeah. And then they have lots of McDonald's everywhere.
Same principle.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And then are there other types of lawsuits?
Yeah, thank you. So there's what I put into a second group of lawsuits. And this one is Gibson versus National Association of Realtors. Mm-hmm. It was filed on the day the verdict, Sitzer Burnett, came out. So Halloween of this year. And the reason why it's in a separate group is because as opposed to the Sitz Burnett and Morrell cases and this copycat one from South Carolina, which are alleging damages on behalf of sellers, this Gibson case is on behalf of the buyers. Oh, so they're saying that the buyers would have paid less of a commission and are owed money because, you know, this should never have happened. And, you know, there should be money awarded to buyers.
If there was no conspiracy, they would have
paid
less in the property they bought because it was built into the price.
That's the argument, right? Okay. So now that's we're getting both sides of it now. So we have the sellers already, you know, and now we're entering the buyer side.
Okay.
Too.
Yeah. All right.
We had one more major group. That is the DOJ, the Department of Justice, the Federal Department of Justice. This takes a quick background. So a couple years ago, NAR entered into an agreement with the DOJ about our clear cooperation rule and participation policy. We were ready to follow the settlement. The DOJ, according to some federal law from a long time ago, has to put these kind of settlements up for notice and comment. We have standard forms come up, right, with proposed changes. Every time we do it, we put them up for notice and comment. We say, this is what we're thinking of doing. What do you feel about it? DOJ, because of this federal law, has to do the same thing with these kind of settlements. So they put it up, and they got back comments that they considered to be too negative and didn't support the decision they had made to enter into an agreement. There was also a change in administration. We went from President Trump's administration to President Biden's administration. And so I think the combined forces of those two things led the DOJ to not only abandon the proposed settlement with NAR on these two proposed rules, but then to actually seek to again to file a new action against them. Mm-hmm. And NAR reasonably said, wait a second, we already had an agreement here, right? Honor your agreement. And so they have filed a case in the district court, which has been appealed now to the DC Circuit Court of Appeals on that issue. But basically, what the meaning of the word closed means. So the antitrust division of the Department of Justice, quote unquote, closed their case against NAR about these two rules. Question is, when they say closed, can it be ever opened again? You know, the NAR's argument.
Double jeopardy.
Yeah. Right. NAR's argument is, they use this useful metaphor. They say that, look, if a parent tells a kid to go in the room and close the door because they're grounded, right? Does a child comply with that rule? Or is a kid listening to the parent, if they go into the room, close the door, and less than a half a second later, open the door and walk out if they comply with the rule, right? Is that closing the door like the parent means? Or do they have to keep it closed for at least a certain amount of time, you know? And so that's what issue in the D.C. Circuit. Now, the D.C. Circuit is aware of what's happening in these other groups of litigation, right? So they, I don't think coincidentally at all, held a hearing on this very issue last Friday. So you remember that on November 20th, Sitzer Burnett had a hearing about this proposed settlement in their case. Then Morrell, the other case that's related to Sitzer Burnett, had a hearing the week after, which I believe on Thursday. And then on the following Friday, so the next day, the federal government has a hearing on this, so what this closed mean.
Waiting thing. On each piece.
They want to see what's going to happen.
And we still don't know what's going to happen. They're all just checking up on each other, waiting on each piece.
Yes, right. And the last thing I guess I'll say about the D.C. Circuit one is that you could tell from the judge's questioning, I sat on the hearing there too, that they were not particularly receptive to the government's case. And they were looking for some kind of reason, which they didn't, it didn't seem apparent at the hearing, would support the antitrust division to reopen the case.
Does DOJ ever do what NAR says they did here? Do you have any concern that what DOJ is doing here will make it harder for future DOJs to convince parties in NAR's shoes that when DOJ says it will close an investigation, it will stay closed for more than a half minute? You point me to a precedent where the government has made a promise in exchange for consideration to close an investigation, and the court has said that the government can reopen the investigation.
We don't have an answer on that hearing yet, because we don't have answers on anything, unfortunately.
Right.
but there will be an order issued in that court eventually, probably in a few weeks.
Thanks for putting those groups. So the first group is claiming that there's a conspiracy that all realtors and brokerage firms, NAR members, are conspiring to charge around the same amount of money to the sellers on commission.
That's right.
The second group is similar, except it's from the buyer point of view that it's conspiracy to charge a certain amount, and then the buyer ends up paying that indirectly through the purchase price.
Yeah.
And then the third group is the Department of Justice, and they're saying that, yes, we came to a settlement against the practices that you had and some of his antitrust practices.
Yeah.
We didn't want to comply with the settlement, but now we're fighting back and forth if we're going to comply with the settlement.
Yeah.
And all three of these are ongoing and will continue for years.
Yeah.
There's other lawsuits that we're reading about, and those are against state entities, state associations, but they're the similar copycat arguments, right?
Very much so.
Okay, so we didn't mention those because they fall into that.
Yeah.
So here's the tough question. Do we have to change anything we do right now?
That's a little bit of a dicey one for me to answer. I don't want to be giving legal advice to people saying that you should change behavior based on what's been happening in these court cases or based on statutes or regulations.
Mm-hmm.
That really should be a decision for you to make on your own.
Mm-hmm.
But we can give guidance on whether it actually changes our law. Nothing changes our law. Our law is the same as it was before these cases existed. You'll remember when we were talking about Sitzer Burnett and Morrell, that there was two parties who entered in a proposed settlement agreement, REMAX and Anywhere Real Estate. Their proposed settlements would be nationwide. So if accepted by the court, and again, we won't know until probably at least April of next year, then it would pseudo affect us here in Hawaii, because to the extent that they practice in Hawaii, those two groups at least would have to follow the procedures outlined in their proposed settlement agreement.
Right. Point was, we don't give advice on how you should do your own practice, and that it doesn't change the laws that govern us and how we run our business. So we should continue to run our business with compliance with state law, with our fiduciary responsibility, and with our ethical requirements that we have as a realtor member.
Right.
Right. Now, I would say, if I can add this, and you can chime if you'd like, that we should be prepared for scenarios from our clients.
Yeah.
For sellers reading the news and saying, well, I read the news about this lawsuit. Does that mean I no longer pay you commission to give to the buyer side? Or a buyer saying something similar and reading the news and saying, wait a minute, do I have to pay my own commission now?
Yes.
And so while we can't give advice on how people should practice in their individual business and individual brokerage firms, I think they should be aware that those scenarios might happen.
Yes, that's a very good point. I can at least give you three what I would call danger zones, right? So things that are at issue in the litigation, all right? So we're not saying you should change your practice because of this, but we can say that these are things that have come up. There's a judgment in Sitzer Burnett against it. Mm-hmm. And if you want to avoid the areas where that have been at issue in those cases, we can at least outline those to you right now. So not saying you should change your practices or the policies, just here are some danger zones. So one would be steering, right? So that would be, you're a buyer agent or a buyer side agent, right? And you go on to the MLS and you look for those commissions that are highest and only show those to your clients because it would be best for you, right? That would be a danger area, right? The argument is that you should be acting as a fiduciary for your client and it shouldn't really matter what the commission rate is. So that would be a danger area. And
our National Association of Realtors Code of Ethics Article 1, it's worth working in the best interest of your client.
Right.
By steering because of what you would get paid under commission, well, that would be the opposite of Article 1.
Right. Yeah. Another thing that would fall under that danger zone of steering would be refusing to work with a listing broker who doesn't operate a cooperating broker commission. Mm-hmm. That is most definitely going to be an issue in that Gibson case. That is the second category of cases, the one that deals with buyers. In that case, they're introducing something like 600 phone calls that Rex Real Estate had received. they were the real estate brokerage, I'm sure people remember, who wouldn't offer a cooperative brokerage commission.
Okay.
And there are many voicemails where there are none from Hawaii that I could hear, but there were many voicemails where they were called from someone saying, hey, my client's interested in this property. It's not on the MLS. What's going on? Mm-hmm. And they would say, oh, yeah, it's not on the MLS. We don't do that. But we encourage you to make an agreement with your buyer. And they would just, in less than pleasant terms, basically hang up on the person.
And you're saying that because Rex had told them they're not offering commission to pay for representation of the buyer, right, and they issued an agreement from your buyer to make that payment.
Okay. Right. And so they're introducing that as evidence of alleged steering.
Thank you for calling Rex. This call may be recorded. Please hold while we connect you to the next available Rex agent.
Connect with a dedicated Rex agent.
Thank you for calling Rex. This is Logan.
Hey, I'm calling because I see an active listing on your website here, but it's nowhere to be found in our MLS.
All right, I do see that one here. And the reason why you didn't see it on the MLS is because we actually don't advertise any of our properties on the MLS. So with that being said, our sellers are not obligated to pay that buyer's agent commission. However, we'd never want you to work for free. Typically, with a buyer agent in your position, the way you're compensated would be by the buyer, but we do make that process very simple with our offer online submission process.
Don't worry about it. I won't bother to show it. Who's your local agent, though? Because I'll make sure and tell people not to work with them.
That has been and will likely be continued to be an issue in these kind of cases.
So the first one was you have a buyer, you see the co-op commission that's being paid for each property, and you and instead of thinking what's best for my buyer, what should I show your buyer, it's steering them towards the one that's paying a higher commission or commission compared to no commission at all. Right. And the second is from the buyer side where you're inquiring about a listing and then either finding out it's not paying a co-op or saying, well, you got to pay a co-op, otherwise I'm not going to bring my buyer to you. So from same thing, looking from different directions. Those are danger zones because they don't right. comply with our code of ethics. They don't comply with the law.
Right.
And that didn't change. And that's how we've been practicing
right. exactly.
our business for a long time.
Yeah. Okay. And that carries into a related concept, which is one that's been spoken a lot about by national leadership, which is showing your values. If there is a situation when there is no cooperating broker commission, you would be in a position where you would have to show your value to the buyer broker saying, you know, I'm showing you this property. There is no cooperating broker commission, but, you know, I'm bringing these services to you and basically convince them perhaps through a buyer broker agreement or otherwise that commission should be paid either by the buyer or they should negotiate it somehow separately with the seller. So that, I think, is what...
Under the confines of a buyer brokerage agreement.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was a recommendation also from National Association of Realtors to work with a buyer brokerage agreement or what we call a buyer representation contract or agreement.
That's related to, I think, the third thing, which, again, not a recommendation, but again, a kind of a danger zone, making sure that the buyer is aware of what the commission is and how it's paid. So you can do that, for instance, through a buyer broker agreement, perhaps, or in the listing agreement or otherwise. It's just one of the things alleged in these cases is that brokers were saying that you don't have to pay anything, that it's actually free. And then the other party says, well, that's not really true because it's baked into the price of the home. You know, they are in effect paying for it by having a higher price. And that was one level of attack against them.
And I remember in 2021,
NAR,
we agreed to a rule change nationally for the realtor rules that said we would not claim and market and say that our services are free because they're not.
Right.
And you wouldn't want them to be free.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
How do we keep abreast of the impact of the lawsuits? And really, because you mentioned these dates.
Yeah.
We're going to go on with our lives. We have this thing called Christmas and New Year's coming up. We'll get distracted. It doesn't happen. How do we make sure we keep up to date?
You keep watching for videos with me and Clomer, and each section video, my hair will get grayer and thinner, and to the point at which I'll probably be a bald, crazy person.
I didn't even know we're doing more videos.
Yes, well, okay. And so we are monitoring all these cases diligently and closely.
So keeping up, that way they can cut to that. We have the newsletters that go out. Maybe we'll do a few more videos.
Yeah.
Is there anything that an individual realtor can do to help the association and our industry? Let me answer that from my part.
That would be great. Yeah.
Because I know what you would say is follow the law and follow the practices and watch for those danger zones. And you've already said that.
Yeah.
I'll say this. Be engaged in our industry. You even have your renewal coming up for your industry and opt in for things like RPAC, investments, So as we invest into our industry, we can use that money to continue to lobby for fair treatment, to lobby for things that are going to protect your industry and private property rights. I'll tell you right now that it is moving, evolving. It's a topic that is very intricate, has depth in all different directions. So being up to date, talking to a broker, have your broker talk to the Legal Kukua line, it makes a big difference. And we'll continue to keep you up to date as we protect our industry, private property rights, and our membership. Aloha. Thank you, Jason.
Aloha. Thank you, Kalama.
Nothing in this podcast creates or confirms an attorney-client relationship, nor does any information contained in this podcast constitute legal advice. You are urged to seek qualified legal counsel of competent jurisdiction for answers to all your legal questions. And that's our episode. Remember, we release new episodes on the first Wednesday of each month. Please join us next month for our next focus piece and for the latest Hawaii real property data. Mahalo. Ahui hou.